Welcome to the next gear on podtech.net. I'm Matt Kelly. Imagine doubling the capacity of our freeways and quadrupling the capacity of available parking, all while being able to go 0 to 60 in under 4 seconds with zero emissions. Well, as commuters grapple with transportation challenges in the 21st century, one company is already addressing the issue. Commuter Cars Corporation has built a new vehicle called Tango to solve these traffic congestion problems on America's roadways and help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And joining me to discuss the Tango and its promise is Rick Woodbury, president of Spokane, Washington-based Commuter Cars Corporation. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First off, tell our community who Commuter Cars is.
Well, Commuter Cars is present a very small company that far over the last 9 years that is, to my knowledge, the only car in the world that will fit in half a lane on the freeway with more clearance than a truck has in a full lane. And it's also short enough, being basically the dimensions of a motorcycle, it can fit perpendicular to the curb and park 4-in-1 standard parallel parking space.
So basically, they're very short and very skinny.
That's correct.
And capable of seating how many people?
Two average proportion, 6'6" people in tandem. I've actually had people as tall as 6'8" comfortably in the car, but they had more legs than torso.
Well, how did you come to be involved in this company and the industry? Talk about your passion for a moment.
I started the company, and it's based on a 25-year history of being frustrated with traffic and wondering why every single car out there is a full size, takes up a full lane, when 90% of them only have one person in them. It just seems about as insane as getting on a New York subway with a backpack that's about 5 times your size, because you're not using that space. And if you're not using it, you're wasting it and causing other people a lot of grief. So I think this all started back in horse and buggy days. I think that, people drove around, rode around by themselves on horseback. At least that's what it seems like from the movies. I wasn't around, I don't remember. And, if you had a buggy, it was probably because you needed to carry two people side by side, or you were rich or whatever reason. But, there probably wasn't the congestion because most people were on horseback, unless they were carrying goods, of course. There's always going to be a need for full-size cars. There's no question about that. It's just that it doesn't make sense for 92 million people in the U.S. to drive to and from work every day with 4 empty seats around them, jamming up all the freeways and polluting and having trouble parking and costing a fortune parking as well.
Well, and I would imagine not just in North America, but this vehicle also has quite a bit of viability in Europe and Asia, where the roads are much thinner, much smaller, and parking is at even a greater premium.
Right. Any crowded city in the world, it doesn't matter where, they all have the same problem. It's amazing.
Well, introduce us to this cute little car, the Tango. Tell us how it came to be in the shape and size that it did.
Sure. I'll kind of go back the history of it. It goes back to about 1980-ish in Los Angeles, just driving to work and noticing that every car around me had only one person in it, and thinking of this absolute, ridiculous traffic jam, and thinking of all the attorneys and doctors and people of high value that are sitting there wasting their time, and thinking of the billions of dollars of time wasted and productivity wasted because of traffic jams, and just multiplying it out, not just through LA, but throughout all the big cities in the world which are like that. So it came to me that, if we had a car that was half a lane width, that could fit in half a lane with the same clearance that a truck had in a full lane, that we could solve the problem. And I figured, well, someday the automotive companies will do that. The first thing that came to mind was that a narrow car would tip over, so I figured there's going to have to be two things that could be done. One is that it would have to tilt like a motorcycle, which is problematic because if the tilting mechanism failed, you'd go over, and I can see why that didn't work. But the other would be to ballast it. And the thing that came to mind immediately to me was ballasting it with iron titanium hydride, which is a storage for hydrogen. I'd been an avid follower of hydrogen energy since 1975, when I read about a hydrogen-powered car. I've actually been kind of a hydrogen nut since I was a very small child, when I did my first electrolysis experiment with Dad. But hydrogen always interested me. I love the idea that you could get energy and have a pop and just water came out. So the idea of a hydrogen car made sense. You figure the weight of the ballast that would hold the hydrogen, or the weight of the hydride that held the hydrogen would be the ballast, and it wouldn't deplete as it got used up as gasoline would. If you use gasoline to ballast the car, when the tank was empty, the car would just flip over, you know. So this was just my thinking at that time, and I thought, well, someday the big auto companies will figure this out and do it. So I thought of it as something in the future. Meanwhile, my son grew up. He was born in 1979, so by the time he was in the fifth grade or so, he was already doodling sketches of my ideas of, you know, narrow cars and hydrogen-powered and all that. And he got a little older, and we started building boats. We started with a kayak, and then we built a gaff rig schooner, a little one, just a day sailor, but a fun little schooner. And we kept getting into all these projects. And one day we got involved in this 35-foot metal schooner, and my wife could see where the things were going. I kind of had this itch to go sail around the world or something, and she finally put her foot down and said, "It's me or the boat, take your choice." So when I chose her, we kind of had to find another project, and serendipitously we wound up looking into developing this car, not expecting to make it a hydrogen car right away, but thinking that if we made a prototype that ran on batteries, even though batteries wouldn't go far enough, at least that was my thinking at the time, that we would go on ahead and build a prototype and prove that we could get enough ballast to make the narrow car work. And this became a fun project, and the more we got into it, the better it looked. And one of the things we found out about, there's a company called AC Propulsion that had built a car that was 0 to 60 in 4 seconds with 100-mile range with simple lead-acid batteries. And that just blew my mind, and I started thinking, wow, we don't need, you know, we don't need hydrogen to make this work. This works right now, today.
Yeah, we've had the opportunity to interview Tom Gage from AC Propulsion about his e-box.
Yeah, he's a friend. I enjoy talking to him. I've met him several times.
So you've brought up a couple of issues then that we want to talk about. For some people, small equals unsafe, particularly against, say, a full-size SUV in a collision. How do you respond to that? You've already addressed the rollover probability with a car such as the Tango. Talk about those for a second, and then bring it into the type of propulsion system that the vehicle already is using.
Well, first of all, safety, I know that's a major concern. It's a major concern for me. I gave up riding motorcycles for exactly that reason, safety. And if you look at the dimensions and the weight of the car, it really is much more substantial than a standard car. First of all, it weighs about 3,000 pounds, 3,050 pounds to be exact. The doors have four times more steel in them than the largest SUV. We went to a junkyard and took this largest SUV's door apart and looked inside, and we found one bar that's smaller than any of the four bars that are in our door. Furthermore, the bar was not attached to either a hinge or a latch at either side. It was just held into place by a spot weld into sheet metal. And I'm not saying it's altogether weak, but it's nowhere near the strength of, say, a NASCAR or, you know, any race car roll cage. Ours is tied in with hinges with 3/8 steel pins at one end with billet stainless hinges that cost $600 a set. At the other end, there are steel pins that go in to tie it into the roll cage into quarter-inch steel plate. So the strength of the doors, for example, from side impact is phenomenal. People say, well, it's really small, but it really isn't small from the dimension of the center of the steering wheel to the outside door panel. Ours is actually wider. It's about 1.5 inches wider in that dimension than, say, a Subaru Outback, for example. So the interior dimension is also just as big. We have 1/2 inch more elbow room than a Subaru Outback, and we have thicker doors. So the dimensions are there, the weight is there. It's just the fact that both sides of the car are the driver's side. So, I mean, yes, you know, if somebody hits you in a passenger side and you're fortunate enough not to have a passenger there, sure, there'd be a lot of crumple zone over there. But the best thing is to keep the other car out of the inside of your car. Race cars don't have airbags, but they do have roll cages exactly the same as we have, and ours is actually certified by FIA, which is the International Racing Organization that keeps track of safety regulations for race cars.
Do you have airbags in the vehicle?
We do not have airbags.
Mm-hmm.
We will have airbags in the production model cars because they're a requirement by law. But since we sell our cars as kit cars with very simple, just a couple hours of assembly required, we are not under the regulations that require the airbags. We go way beyond it in safety, in my opinion. Like I say, race cars don't have airbags, and they crash at 200 miles an hour, and our exact same cage is used in those crashes, and most people survive.
On to propulsion. You were a lover of hydrogen. Are you still as in love with hydrogen, or are you looking more at batteries as the future?
I still like hydrogen very much. I think it's just way too expensive. I think that the issue is cost, performance, range, and all of that. And I know a lot of people who are electric vehicle aficionados are very down on hydrogen, feeling that it's a put-off and it's a game and so forth. But I've been following hydrogen for, 30 years or so now, and I still find it very viable if some of the hurdles can be overcome. But they're big hurdles, and they're very expensive. One, the fuel cells are expensive. Two, the storage isn't very efficient yet. You know, there's an infrastructure needed. There's quite a few issues with hydrogen. So I feel that, batteries are a much better thing. Now, the one thing that's interesting, and I'd like to point out some statistics about the about commuting in general, just to show you where this fits in. There are 118 million workers in the U.S., and 92 million of them drive by themselves to work every day, and they only average 20 miles. So the average commuter would be well suited with just lead-acid batteries. So the need for lithium-ion and long-range batteries is not really there. We could develop a car right now today with inexpensive batteries, sell it for under $20,000 if we had orders for, say, you know, if we could build 10,000 of them a year and know that we had that kind of volume. We would be able to build those cars for under $20,000, and I'm sure that the cars would pay for themselves many places just in parking fees alone, because it's so compact it can park like a motorcycle. The fact that electric cars haven't worked, in my opinion, is mostly because of battery technology. People who buy cars that are full cars, SUVs or full family cars, expect them to do what family cars do, and that's be able to drive across the country and do all the things that they do. That would require a phenomenal infrastructure, extremely expensive batteries, recharging or hydrogen or any number of other things. However, if you have a car that you just use 90% of the time, which is for getting to work and back, getting groceries, running around town or whatever with one or two people in it, this is the one you use for that. It's like if you walk into your garage and you have a choice between a motorhome and a car and you want to drive downtown to some city, you're probably not going to choose a motorhome unless there's some really good reason for it. By the same token, if you have a Tango and a car in your garage, the Tango would be the obvious choice because it's so much more convenient, it's more fun, it's faster, etc.
Well, and let's also kind of expound on that just a little bit more. Talk about in terms of the amount of gas that's wasted in traffic and the cost to the environment.
Yeah, according to the last report I read from the Texas Transportation Institute, there are 5.7 billion gallons of gasoline wasted just due to traffic congestion in the U.S. alone. You can multiply that by about 3 for the world figures. That 5.7 billion gallons would fill tank trucks lined up end-to-end all the way from New York City to Las Vegas and all the way back. That's just the annual waste due to traffic congestion. So the cost of the gasoline that propels, say, well, I base these figures on 50 million cars. I'm figuring that 50 million of the single occupant commuters, 50 million of the 92 million, will eventually want to be driving Tangos. And yeah, I just figure it's a good number to use. So if 50 million did that, that would save $42 billion in fuel. There's actually $67 billion wasted, but there's $42 billion in fuel would be used for these cars. The amount of electricity used would be $7.3 billion. So it's almost 6-to-1 or something. So it's about 6 times cheaper to drive the electric car than it is to drive gasoline. This is retail versus retail, so we don't have to worry about, you know, how much energy was used to pull the oil out of the ground or how much energy was used to do all these various things. I mean, obviously, the environmental consequences aren't paid for, but the retail cost of just getting the material, either electricity or gasoline, the electricity wins out at as much as a 6-to-1 ratio, depending on where you live and what your electric bills are.
So currently the Tango is using a lead acid battery for a propulsion system, is that correct? And it's got a plug-in capability?
Well, George Clooney's has a lead acid battery, and it's, you know, fairly short range because of that. The maximum range with a lead acid battery is pretty much 50 miles of freeway driving, and it's about 100 miles for nickel metal hydride and about 150 miles for the A123 lithium ion batteries. We're developing another lithium ion pack that's a prismatic cell specifically designed for the Tango, and that should get about a 200 mile range or better. So it really depends on the batteries. We don't really care what battery a person wants to order. It turns out that 7 of the next 10 cars that we're building right now are getting $40,000 lithium ion packs, just because, you know, and the car's already $108,000, what's another 40, you know?
Well, I did want to kind of get to cost, and I mean, at the price that we're talking about here, they're not really available to the average consumer at this time, is that correct?
No, I mean, I certainly couldn't afford one if this is out of my salary. No, it's not, but the thing is that the only way to stay in business is to make a profit, and if you start saying, well, we're going to sell X number of cars, so we're going to sell them at this cheap price, and you wind up going broke before you make a profit, then you're out of business, and then nobody benefits. So we had basically two choices when we built this car. We could either build it as cheap as possible, in which case it would have cost maybe $60,000 to build each one, and then basically the people who wanted it couldn't afford it, and the people who could afford it wouldn't want it. So we decided to try to make the car appeal to people who could afford it, whether or not they were environmentally inclined or not. It so happens that basically all of our customers are environmentally inclined and can afford it. That's good, but it appeals to people who just want to get through traffic faster. It really doesn't matter if they're environmentally inclined or not. This is a something that will save you its purchase price. If you're a $200,000 a year executive, this car will pay for itself in a number of years just with the time saved for many, many people in places like LA, San Francisco, etc. I mean, if you're driving a car and you spend X number of hours in traffic, you can add up the hours at $100 an hour and you'll see that, you know, it pays off pretty quickly.
What are the challenges to getting this car into mass production and affordable and available to the masses?
Well, just raising capital, and, you know, we're not willing to give the company a way to raise that capital, but, you know, by the same token, we have to earn the trust of the investor in order to, attract capital. So I think the most important thing we can do is what we're doing right now, which is selling cars at a profit. And if we're doing that with $100,000 to $150,000 cars and we're making a profit, then people will invest in it. If they don't invest, we will still, with the profit, eventually be able to make the cars cheaper and cheaper. It'll just be a longer process. So instead of maybe, let's just say, for example, that somebody trusted us today with $50 million and invested that much in the company, then we would be able to build the cars within 2 years. We should be able to have cars on the road for under $20,000 each. So bingo, we're there. You know, and that would be a 10,000 per year production. So the two things. One is the investor would have to have faith in us as our capability of running the company and actually accomplishing the goal, and the investors would have to have the confidence that there's that big a market. And I think, you know, I'm more than convinced. In fact, I believe that the world market for this car is 150 million cars. But that's, you know, that's me, and that's based on my research. And I'm still quite confident of those numbers.
Where does government fall into play in all of this in trying to help spur the implementation of these vehicles? And also, where does the role of the consumer fall in all of this?
You know, basically, we're just selling the cars to consumers that can afford it now. And as the price comes down, more consumers will be able to afford them, and it'll become more and more, and more people will realize the great benefit of it, and people will avoid their cars and drive Tangos instead as much as they can, and they'll be much happier for it. The government will be very, very pleased that they won't have to build so many new highways, or maybe any at all. They'll put a stripe down the lane when there's enough of these cars out there, so they have a great incentive to do that. In California and Europe and the Orient, you can lane split, drive right between the cars in a traffic jam, which saves you a tremendous amount of time. this car is 5 inches narrower than Goldwing and lane splits nicely. And 30 police officers that I've questioned now, most of them Highway Patrol, have all said they wouldn't ticket it. And when I was just down at Joshua Tree National Park talking to a couple of Highway Patrolmen, they said that the photographer who was photographing the Tango asked them directly, would you ticket me for lane splitting? And they said, hell no. I said, not at all. This is fine. And they said, if somebody did give you a ticket, you'd win in court. There's not a judge in the city that would allow it. That was their opinion. I mean, I'm not saying that you can't get a ticket. I'm not saying a judge won't overthrow it. But, you know, it's legal for motorcycles that are 5 inches wider than the Tango. Why wouldn't it be legal for the Tango?
I wanted to ask you, though, do you think government has a responsibility in terms of incentives, et cetera, to try to spur the development of the type of businesses such as yourself? Or do you think that small business or big business is doing just fine handling this technology and bringing it to market?
It sounds to me like it's a liberal versus conservative question, and I just basically don't need to take either side. What I say is that if the government helps, that's wonderful. If they don't help, that's okay too, because it's going to work either way. The Democrats love our car because it's environmentally beneficial. It has all these great benefits. The Republicans like it because it solves a great public problem with private funds. So it means less government, less construction, less highway construction, less expense. So it looks real good on that side. So both sides seem to love our car.
And less dependent on foreign oil, which potentially can help national security.
Exactly. It has so many benefits. They're just unbelievable.
Give me your final thoughts about commuter cars, the development of the new Tango, and the promise it represents for consumers and the environment.
Sure. Well, I think that the Tango is the answer to commuting. It's the only car in the world that will fit in half lane on the highway, and it's the only car that can park like it does. It's an extremely useful vehicle that I don't think anybody would want to drive another way in the city if it's within the range and the capability of the Tango. So I think it has tremendous potential. I think it's just a matter of how long it takes to raise the capital or earn the capital, whichever comes first, or get it granted from the government, another option. We don't care where it comes from. We just want to build 150 million cars, and I'm not doing this to personally get rich. In fact, I live on a $24,000 a year income, and I'd be happy to continue with that indefinitely as long as I have enough to eat and so forth. All I want to do is solve these problems. That's what's exciting to me. That's what drives me. There was one thing that I didn't really answer. You asked about the drive system earlier, and I thought I should touch on that. It has two advanced DC motors in it, which are off the shelf. They're very powerful, over 500 foot-pounds of torque. And in relation to a car, each of those motors has more torque than a Dodge Viper V10 engine. So it only needs one gear, and it's like a freight train, which has direct drive motors that take them from 0 to 90 miles an hour or so, all in one gear. Ours, with one gear, because the car is a lot lighter than a freight train, we can run it from 0 up to over 150 miles an hour in one gear. So tremendous amount of power. The batteries actually translate out to something like 2,000 horsepower if you use these lithium-ion batteries, so they will not be the weak link anymore. The motors probably will be. But even with lead-acid batteries, we can achieve a 0 to 60 in 4 seconds and a quarter mile in about 12 seconds at well over 100 miles an hour. The lead-acid batteries sag to about half the voltage and do not deliver the horsepower, so you're looking at only about 300 horsepower. The controller puts out 2,000 amps at over 300 volts, which is 600 kilowatts, which is equivalent to about 800 horsepower gross. So maybe to the wheels you won't get more than 600 horsepower under ideal conditions, but that's still enough to make it one of the fastest cars on the road, really supercar performance on the drag strip. It has a rollover threshold similar to a Porsche 911, so it goes around corners very well. Despite its looks, it just slides sideways because it's such a low center of gravity with 2,000 pounds under the floor. And it's just basically, I think, the most exciting car you can drive in the city. There's just nothing can touch it. Nothing comes close.
Have any of the large automakers taken notice of this vehicle?
Yes, General Motors took notice of it and actually was very interested in investing in giving us parts at cost and distribution as well. But I think that, you know, companies don't like to be dictated to by the government, and I can understand their feeling of not wanting to just comply with the California Resources Board mandate, which is the reason that they would have been interested in our car. I mean, that's why they were interested in it, was to meet their mandate. And this was quite a number of years ago, when they were able to get an injunction against the state and not have to comply. It was a safer way for business. I'm not saying it was the ethical choice. I'm just saying that it's a business choice. Their business is to make money for their investors, and it's their job to stay in business. And they're not doing a real good job of that. None of them are. Maybe Toyota's doing all right, but I mean, the big three here are not doing that well. And so they have to weigh, you know, what's going to happen if they comply? Well, if they comply, it's going to cost them X amount of dollars and so forth. If they don't comply, it's $400 million. If they can get out of it through a lawsuit, it's, you know, whatever the attorney fees were, probably a lot less than either of those choices. So they apparently made that choice, and it would be hard for them to be supporting an electric car out of one side of their mouth and then saying in court that electric cars don't sell, which they don't. You know, I mean, I tend to agree with them. Full-size electric cars have a very limited market. Environmentalists will love them, but unless they get a tremendous range and equivalent to a gasoline car, I think that they have a very limited market. I'm not ever going to say no market. There's always a market for everything, and the EV1 proved that. Whether or not there are really orders for thousands more or not, it still wasn't the hundreds of thousands that they would need to make that exciting to them, because that's the kind of thing that a company like General Motors needs. They have a $160 billion nut they have to meet every year, and unless something is going to help them meet that, then it doesn't really belong on the table for them. So anyway, these are just my opinions based on my experience in talking to various auto executives and so forth.
And where can we get more information about the Tango?
Okay, commutercars.com has basically all you need to know. We are taking orders for the T600 for $108,000 for the lead-acid battery version, up to $148,000 for the lithium-ion. There's a nickel-metal hydride in between. We also have two other models that are projected for the future, the T100, which is 100 kilowatt, T200, 200 kilowatt. The T100 is projected at $18,700 once we have enough to build 10,000 per year. The T200, we might be able to get onto market sooner because it would probably justify somewhere around 3,000 cars per year, but that one would be $39,000 projected. If we get enough deposits, we will... It generates interest from investors so that we can actually get the funds to build these cars. There's no telling how many it will take for certain, but I would imagine if we had 1,000 or more deposits, investors would look at our company with a lot more interest. Right now, we have about less than 150 total deposits between all three models, I'd say.
Rick Woodbury, president of Spokane, Washington-based Commuter Cars Corporation. A pleasure having you on the podcast today.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
We'll look forward to hearing more about Commuter Cars Corporation and the Tango in the months and years ahead. For The Next Gear, I'm Matt Kelly on podtech.net.